Erev Shabbat Shalom. I decided to try an experiment, and I hope I can be, consistent with this. But I was asked this morning to give a shiur in my local synagogue and about the Parsha, and I decided that it might not be a bad idea to share it with you. Share it with you first. Those of you who live in Israel don't have a lot of, won't have a lot of time to hear this. This is, it's 4:27, so maybe this will be a Motzei Shabbat shiur. It'll have Pesach implications, by the way, so it's not as if it's not relevant. But those of you who live further away, perhaps this will give you material to think about for Shabbat. This is a tough. It's interesting. It's a tough. Vayakel Pekudei is a very challenging Parsha to speak about, if only because it's most of it is extremely technical. Parsha begins with a discussion of the laws of Shabbat, and then it ends at the very end of Pekudei. It's a double sedra. You have the description of the setting up of the tabernacle after it was all planned and executed by Bezalel and his assistants under Moshe Rabbeinu's aegis. And in the middle, just twice, the Torah runs through all of the details about how the Mishkan has to be built. So normally, what people, I think, do is they either talk about the importance of bringing God's presence into the home or into the synagogue, which is the last part of the Parsha, or they talk about Shabbos, which is the beginning of the Parsha. As it happens, this Shabbat is Shabbat HaChodesh. It's the Shabbat before Nisan, because Rosh Chodesh is on Sunday, tomorrow night and Sunday. And so that has all the dinim of Pesach, so I'm sure that a lot of rabbis are actually sitting there very reliant, you know, oh, thank God there's something to talk about, because Vayakel Pekudei is a really difficult parsha. Nevertheless, I'm going to take a shot at discussing the Parsha, and Dafka, a part of the one line which is very well known. It does deal with Shabbat, so maybe I'm actually giving in to the Eitz HaRa to find something interesting, but from an angle which is a little bit different. I'd like to address the verse at the end of the short discussion of Shabbat that you find in Parshat Vayakel, which after the Torah goes out of its way to say you shouldn't do any malach on Shabbat and you should not, and otherwise it'll bring the direst of circumstances. It ends sort of as an afterthought with a verse that is actually quite well known but not fully understood. Lo tivaru esh b'chol moshevotechem b'yom haShabbat. You shall not burn fire anywhere in your dwellings, meaning outside the land of Israel and as well as in the land of Israel, on Shabbat itself. So the Talmud already and the early Midrashim, never mind the medieval commentators, all asked the question, why single out this one melacha, this one form of action, which normally should be subsumed under the traditionally organized 39 forms of activity, which are forbidden on Shabbat? That's the question which occupies Ashkenazim. It's interesting. That's the question that occupies Ashkenazim down the line. Rashi, for example, tersely in his typical fashion, says, Yesh merabotenu ormim havara lelav yatzat, yesh ormim lechalek yatzat. There is a machloket among the rabbis, why single out the burning of fire on Shabbat when in fact should have been subsumed into the other activities that are forbidden. So Rashi points out that there's a controversy among a difference of opinion among the rabbis and the Talmud as to whether the function of singling out the prohibition against lighting fire on Shabbat is because it's of less severity. Because you can't make it more severe. The other 38 activities on Shabbat carry the death penalty, or whether it's spiritual death if you do something by uh, if you're not caught, or physical death, technically, according to the Torah, it can't be more serious. So what could it be? It must be less serious. So perhaps it's putting on lights on Shabbos, lighting fire, cooking, all this other stuff might be of less import and of less gravity. And the other opinion, says Rashi, is no, that the Torah sort of was a footnote. It's like, almost like it's kind of odd. As a footnote, saying, okay, you can't do anything, and there were these 39 things you're not allowed to do, but especially I want to highlight the prohibition against lighting fire. Why? To teach us that every single of the 39 activities which are not allowed to be done, which we don't allow to be done on Shabbat, actually has its own integrity, it has its own status. It's not a matter of you have to do all 39 to be able to be considered a Mechalel Shabbat. Every single category is independent, just as is the case with lighting fire. That's and as I said, the Ashkenazim, that's where they go with, and that's all discussion, and there's tremendous amount of Talmudic analysis as the relationship between the two sides, and so on and so forth. Striking, what's really striking, is the Sfardim. Not Mizrahi, because it doesn't start in Spain, it actually starts in Babylonia with Rav Sadia Gaon. Ibn Ezra, for example, and I'm going to put up I'll put up the sources with this. Ibn Ezra, for example, makes the point. He says, I'm going to read it straight out. He said, Amar ata b'shabbat lo tevaru esh le'afot lechem l'shel basar ki ha'esh tzorech l'chol ma'achal. He said, why would you tell somebody not to use fire? So the answer is, for a very simple reason, that you need fire to cook. That's what people generally use fire for. They also use it to illuminate the house. Okay, but in this context, that's what really is bothering Ibn Ezra, which is kind of strange. You ask, why not putting a veil to put on lights on Shabbat? Because it's absolutely living in the dark is not easy. We don't know what it's like to live without 24-hour illumination. There's a wonderful book that I bought on Amazon, actually, called Illumination, The History of Lighting Houses, The History of Lighting Expanses. And we are really not at all aware of the revolution that electricity wrought in the lives of people, because generally, most people, unless you were really, really wealthy, because candles were amazingly expensive, when the lights went out or the candles burned down, you went to sleep because you couldn't use the nighttime. It's one of the reasons why the Rambam, quoting Chazal, makes a big deal of the fact that people were able to study at night, get more credit, because that requires tremendous devotion. How do you study at night? The Rambam assumed that it was better to know that learning by heart was an integral part of the act of Talmud Torah. So he would sit there at night and recite whatever it was. In his case, like, he probably meant the Mishnah Torah, and you would sit and discuss things that you would recite by heart and then analyze them. But nighttime was unused time. The fact that we can use the nighttime is a very big deal. So why not say that, why not emphasize as well that the Torah is coming here to tell you can't light things to illuminate your home. The reason appears to be a point which sounds almost contemporary. Nachmanides, in one of the cases where he adopts the interpretation of Ibn Ezra, now Nachmanides in general, those who were interested in this one point, had something of a conflicted relationship with Ibn Ezra. In his introduction to his commentary on the Torah, he just effusively praises Rashi. He calls him Amenorah HaTahorah, the pure candelabrum. I'm going to follow Rashi, through thick and thin, which he doesn't always. He quotes Rashi, but he doesn't hesitate to disagree with him. Ibn Ezra, he says, it's a different story. Ibn Ezra is a problematic person. He says things which are controversial. So he says, I will have, with Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, I will have tochacha gluya ve ahava mesuterit. I'm going to I'm going to lock horns with him. I'm going to disagree with him. I will never hesitate to criticize him or to rebuke him. But, you know, at the end of the day, I really love him. There's something really amazing about him. And this is one of these cases where he sort of just flows with it. And he adopts Ibn Ezra's position. And he says, it's a long Ibn Ezra. He says, the point of this Pasuk, he says, Inyana katuv hazeh, vaday le'esor b'shabbat gam milechol milechet ofan nefesh. He said, there's no question in my mind, says Ibn Ezra, that the reason why the Torah had to single out the prohibition against using fire on Shabbat is because on other occasions you can use fire. When do you use fire? Use fire to cook. What is he talking about? And he goes on in discussion. He says, points out an obvious contrast. In this week's Parsha, in the second Torah that we're going to read tomorrow, from Parshat HaChodesh, when the Torah first lays out the calendar, and then it lays out the rules of the first Pesach, which are those of you who are studying Daf Yomi, know it was just a couple of parakim ago, and then goes on and discusses not just the laws of Pesach, but also the laws of Chag, the laws of Yom Tov. And central central verse in the laws of the holidays is the verse that you lo tzasu kom lacha lo yaseh bachem. You should not do any form of melacha, any of the 39 categories of action. Ach asher yachel lechol nefesh hu yilavado yaseh bachem. Only that which is related to the preparation of food, that's okay. And, if people who are observant know that you can, if there are two major exceptions between Chag, meaning Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, and Shabbat, is that on Yom Tov you can cook. You can use fire. All right, the whole discussion about whether you can light the fire or not, that's a question of Yisur Midrabanan, but once there's fire, you can use it. Says the Ramban, that's all very well and good. This pasuk comes to tell you that that doesn't apply on Shabbat. That you can't equate the two, and that concerns or requirements for cooking do not override Shabbat. The Ramban then goes off on his own analysis, but question has to be asked. Wait a minute, what's bugging the Ramban? Usually you say, what's bothering Rashi? Why do Ibn Ezra and the Ramban both say that this is coming to sort of polemicize a position which would argue that that you should be able to cook on Shabbat, that you should be able to use fire? So here, and it's not at all, I think, a coincidence. Some 800 years after the Ibn Ezra, and 700 years after, no, hold on. Oh, here I go again, I can't remember. 700 years after Ibn Ezra, and 600 years, there we go, after Ramban, sitting in Pressburg, Bratislava, Slovakia, Hungary, those borders were always moving all the time also. Rabbi Moshe Schreiber, the Chatam Sofer, says, it's very simple. The argument could easily be made that the subjective enjoyment of Shabbat, the mitzvah of Onig Shabbat, should override the malachot. My subjective experience, if I want to enjoy Shabbat, I need to be able to have food. If I need to have food, what happens if I didn't have a chance to cook? So obviously my experience of Shabbat should in fact override any restrictions that Torah has. Otherwise, how will I experience a Shabbat atmosphere? And it's a really reasonable question. And there's no question in my mind that that question was asked or posed or the challenge was made to Ibn Ezra and to Ramban and to by Jewish reformers, no doubt, in 19th century Hungary, because that was where he was, that's where the Ramban, that's where the Chatam Sofer, the Rabbi Schreiber, was functioning. So they came to tell us, both of, all three interpret the verse basically the same way, as saying, yes, absolutely, the experience of Shabbat, the physical experience of Shabbat, including eating and drinking and enjoying and so on, is critical for its enjoyment. How the Torah says, everything has to be done before. Shabbat is the kind of experience which requires that everything be prepared for in advance, so that Shabbat is actually oneg. It's actually the pleasure of Shabbat netto. You can ask. Then we can ask about our question about with regard to chag. That's another discussion. That's another discussion. So that's really the question. It's a question of the sub. So what? In other words, the way that that Ibn Ezra and the Ramban and the Chatam Sofer all understood the need for taking this verse and placing it out of context. It's sort of like a, you know, here's a major point made based on what is seemingly a footnote, is how do you decide between the objective demands of the Torah, of the law, and the no less important subjective requirements of enjoying Shabbat. If you want to say it's punitive to a certain degree, that might be very well be true, because you'll never make that mistake again. But as Chazal say in Tractate Avodah Zarah, in a passage which was actually made famous by Agnon, Mi shetarach be'erev Shabbat yochal b'Shabbat. If you make your preparations, you will eat. If not, not. This leads to the whole question of preparations and run-ups to holidays, which is a subject that my teacher Rav Soloveitchik used to discuss extensively. But that's not for now. I'd like to go in a different direction right at the moment. Okay. Let's flip back to the. That seems to have been the challenge. People said, no, I want to enjoy Shabbos. If I forgot, so why doesn't my subjective need override the objective demand of the Torah? Where were such people coming from? So normally I would say, I mean, my first gut reaction would be, especially when it comes to Ibn Ezra and Ramban, I'd say, not the Karaites. They were constantly, that was the other denomination that was very, very aggressive and very, very popular, and throughout the Muslim world, and even to some parts of the Ashkenazic world, at least indirectly, in the Middle Ages, and say maybe that's what they were arguing. The problem is that the Karaites were a funny kind of schismatic group who ended up leaving the Jewish people because they refused to accept the basic definition of who's Jewish, but that's, again, it's contemporary, it's actually very, very pertinent, but not for now. The Karaites have the distinction of being the only Reformed Jewish movement that I know of, or anybody I know knows of, which was far stricter, far more extreme than the Judaism they were going against. The Karaites basically argued that you guys, you Rabbinites, you people of the Talmud, you are you guys are absolutely far and away. Don't take this over seriously. You, when it says Lo Tivaru Esh Melochol Moshvot Techem B'Yom HaShabbat, you shouldn't burn fire on Shabbat. It doesn't mean you shouldn't light the fire, which is one possible interpretation of the verb Lo Tivaru, but rather you shouldn't let fire exist. They would put out the fires. They would sit in the dark on Friday night and would refuse to have hot food on Shabbat. So no Karaite would have come up with this idea that maybe the Torah was, you know, maybe the Torah, you should have really thought of this idea of allowing the use of fire on Shabbat proper. I just doesn't fit there. It's a blatant. So what are we talking about? I think that what we're talking about is a possibility. I'm not saying that this is definite, but it's a possibility. Shabbat, it raises a very serious religious challenge to the individual, especially within a world which is Western, a world which is influenced by Greek and Roman philosophy, and then later by scholastic philosophy, which is heavily or Muslim philosophy, heavily based on the Greeks, and in fact it's true down till today. Greek philosophy has a marked tendency to be binary. It's either or. Something can't be both N. I'm sorry, it's N logic. Both A and not A. People in general have a tendency, they certainly have an inclination, to go to extremes. Now, it's true what Emerson said, that a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, which is also true. But, you know, that's a natural thing. What's the challenge of Shabbat? Shabbat is the most sacred day of the year. It's more serious and it has more gravitas than Yom Kippur even. And there were not a few people. Some of them actually were part of the Dead Sea cults in Qumran and elsewhere, but also among the rabbis, felt that, you know what? Shabbat is so holy that it should be a totally spiritual day. We should just absolutely transcend our physical nature and fast. Concentrate on the spiritual. There is even a statement, and there were rabbis who thought like this. There were rabbis who, for example, this is the Talmud says in Brachot, Daf Lamed Aleph Amud Bet 31b, V'amar Rabbi Elazar Mishum Rabbi Yossi Ben Zimra. This was a statement of Rabbi Elazar in the name of Rabbi Yossi Ben Zimra. Kol HaYoshev B'Ta'anit B'Shabbat. Anybody who fasts on Shabbat, Korim Lo Gzar Dino Shel Shivim Shana. Okay? That's an amazingly good thing to do, because that all of your sins will be forgiven. Nevertheless, you'll end up having to pay for having foregone enjoying Shabbos, which means physical enjoyment. Onig Shabbat means, that's why when you invite people over your house for food, that's why it's called Onig Shabbat, because eating, especially we're talking about Jews here, is a major part of this. But what's striking is the fact that he's willing to say that a person who neglects or who fasts on Shabbos, has that option. There is something to that. There's validity to that. And you can trace all kinds of other sort of distant echoes of this attitude that Shabbat is so holy, I shouldn't eat. In other words, I'm making Yom Kippur, but with a nice, with a positive atmosphere as opposed to an atmosphere of dread. And there were many people like that. This was apparently, especially in Eretz Israel, not an uncommon practice. In fact, there is, in the 9th century, there was a polemicist for the Geonim in Babylonia who wrote a series of really nasty letters to either to Eretz Israel or to a community of Eretz Israel emigrants in North Africa, saying, you guys are off the wall. Eating on Shabbat is like the highest of highest of highest. You end up getting, if you don't, your machal, he calls it nothing less than chilul Shabbat. In other words, if you don't eat hot food and nice food and whatever on Shabbat, it's as if you did melacha. You've destroyed Shabbos. It's absolutely unforgivable. He quotes the psukim from our pasuk, from our parsha. Very simple. So, and you have, and this push on the part of the Geonim and of the Rabbanim in Babylonia and throughout the Mediterranean literal, especially under the influence of the Geonim, against any sign of asceticism on Shabbat, any sign of self-denial, and extolling to the height the need and the importance and the sublime nature of eating and drinking and enjoying Shabbat, because it's also has a physical, it has a physical aspect to it as well as the spiritual. Well, you know what? In light of that inside Jewish push to emphasize how much you have to enjoy Shabbat physically as well as spiritually, you can more than understand why that it wasn't Karait who came to Ibn Ezra or the Ramban or the many other rabbis who were at, who sort of dealt with this question, but asked, wait a minute, if that's so important, so why shouldn't it override Melechet Ochol? Why shouldn't it override the Torah's prohibition against using fire, if it's that important? And the answer, apparently, you know, and so comes the Ramban, and comes Ibn Ezra and the others who went along these lines and said, you know what, that's really true. That's really true. That's a question, but that's not the answer. The answer is that the subjective elements, experiential elements of Jewish life are very important, but they are always secondary. They always defer to the bottom line of what the Torah demands and the limitations that the Torah puts on it. The subject never overrides the objective, as valid and as desirable as those elements might be. Nevertheless, because there is this tendency within rabbinic Judaism to emphasize the restriction over the positive performance, it's very clear that this push for enjoying Shabbat, the Onik Shabbat, which is according to Chazal was ordained already by the prophets. It's based on a pasuk in Yeshayahu. That they had to work overtime to press that because people maybe I don't know why, but people have a tendency. Look, we've all seen this in our own lives. We've seen people who are like their Shulchan Aruch. They're Kitzur Shulchan Aruch types, or the Mishnah Berurah types. They're people that are so careful about every single din, but they forget to experience. It's true of the performance of every mitzvah. There's a book that I once saw in a shul, and it's Yathik. It's really Yathik. I don't have it, and I have no room. I would have no room to put it now, anyways. Get the shelf, anyways, anywhere. Because this is, by the way, those of you who follow me, this is like just this is a small part of the total. It's called Tefillah Kihilchata, prayer, proper prayer, halachic prayer, and endless rules, endless discussions: how you stand it, how you walk it, how you talk it, where you stop it, where you should interrupt it. Ah, it goes on forever. There's one thing that's not in this book: davening. The experience of prayer. And that's what Rav Soloveitchik worked very hard to make sure that was what he emphasized. He this idea that everything is halakha, it's true. Halakha is an unbending, permanent framework but it's our responsibility to fill it with content. And because of that, the rabbis went out of their way to push away this idea that the subjective element is not there, or the personal enjoyment of Shabbat is not relevant. Because that endangers the spiritual element, which is supposed to be infused inside, with which the law is supposed to be infused. Which brings me to an important aspect of Pesach, which is related to that. As I said, most people in many, especially Greek-based Western society, has trouble. I mean, from Plato on, actually, maybe before, but certainly from Plato on, Western philosophies had a problem with the integration between the mind and the body. We've all heard of the mind-body problem. Part of one expression of that is that the mind is more important than the body, and that division is at the basis of Christianity, where the body and the drives of the body are bad, and they need to be, a person needs to be redeemed from them to save the soul. That is, and so as a result, the idea of Oneg Shabbat, that physically enjoying a holiday, the most sacred day of the year, I mean every week, but it's, as I said, if the sanctity of Shabbat is greater than that of Yom Kippur in spades, how do you integrate that with how do you integrate the body and the soul and the body and the spirit with that? So here I would like to share with you, and this is actually going to have implications for this year's Erev Pesach. Rav Soloveitchik in a book called Festival of Freedom, which is Essays on the Pesach Haggadah in Hebrew, it's called Zman Chirutenu. This is actually a notebook that came from another book. Those who are not familiar with his writings, Family Redeemed this actually came from there, but the editors published it separately. The Rav talks about the nature of the Jewish attitude towards eating. And he says that the difference in eating, and there's a difference in eating and the Jewish concept of se'uda, meal. What's the difference? Says the Rav as follows. At the root of the halachic conception of the se'uda lies a problem which assailed the minds of our sages. Man responds to the biological pressure to take nourishment. He has no choice in the matter because the natural need for food is compelling and the drive is irresistible. So acts the brute, the beast in the field, so acts the insect, and so on. I'm going to skip a little bit. All right? Many of the Greek philosophers of the schools of the Stoa and the Cynics actually reached the conclusion that eating is a disgraceful necessity. Eating gratifies not the humanus, the humane part of man, but the beast in man. Pleasure one derives is of sensual, carnal, rather than spiritual nature. All right? One could actually argue that even people that are gourmands, Epicurean, by the way, is by definition irreconcilable with Judaism because it posits that there's no God, Chalila, and that there's no judgment, and you should just, like, you know, stuff your face because you might drop dead tomorrow. The Rav points out that we have, that Judaism has provided, has taught us the idea of se'uda. What does se'uda mean? Se'uda means eating before God. What does that mean? The Suda is neither, this is page 6, it is neither an ordinary meal nor a feast. It is more than that. It is the crucible in which the bread of man is transposed into the bread of God. It expresses the fellowship between God and man and the participation of God in all human pursuits and activity. In other words, we sanctify, the Torah sanctifies the act of eating, transforms it into an act of worship. It doesn't deny, on the contrary, because man is created in the image of God, and he allows us, he gave us our senses, so therefore enjoying the food is part of worship of God. But also we're supposed to elevate the act of eating by discussing Divrei Torah, and so on. Now the concept of Suda is especially present on Shabbat, on Chag, and on Chag. It's also present on the occasion of a Sudat Mitzvah. In other words, the meal that you have to celebrate the performance of a mitzvah, whether it's a wedding, whether it's a Brit Milah, whether it's a Zevet Abbat, whether it's a Pidyon HaBen, whatever the case might be. What's striking, however, and this is the point I want to emphasize, is there was a fundamental difference between these seudot. When you have a seudat mitzvah, when you celebrate the occasion, a happy occasion, which is involved in mitzvah, basically you do something, and by doing that mitzvah, you have basically created a context within which the meal is elevated and becomes a celebration of something divine and something sublime. Shabbat and Chag are a whole other ballgame. Shabbat and Chag are also the meals, the three meals on Shabbat and the meals on Chag are certainly mitzvot. But here we have something very striking. Again, this is for those of you who are studying Daf Yomi. Talmud says, the Gemara Pesachim, Daf Kufhei Amud Aleph, 105a, it's a couple of days ago, that Rabbi Hanina, Rabbi Shlemia, and the students of Rav were sitting together in a Suda on Friday afternoon, and Shabbat was coming. So they said, well, should we, you know, bench? Should we end this meal and start another meal for purposes of Shabbat or not? Okay, I don't want to get to the details of you. Those of you who have been studying Daf Yomi are well aware of the whole questions at the beginning of this chapter by Paris Mapu Makadesh and so on. The Gemara says, comes to the conclusion, that no, you don't have to. Shabbat kovat latzma. That the descent of Shabbat transforms a pre-existing meal and automatically turns it into a Sabbath meal. The context of sanctity, which is created by itself willy-nilly with sunset, transforms the entire context within which we eat, where we live, and also the meal that we had already started. And then the Gemara makes a very strange, seemingly comparison. It says the same way that Shabbat kovat lemaser, I kovat lekiddush. Now, let me have to give you a little background here. Those of us who have the privilege of living here in Eretz Yisrael know that, well, we rely on the various authorities to do this. But if you, like we in my house, I have a little garden, that when you grow anything in the land of Israel, before you can eat it, you have to separate tithes. The trumag is given to the Kohen, or we burn it. Nowadays, part should go to a Levi, and another part should go to a Kohen, and then as part of a three-year cycle, sometimes you give 10% to tzedakah, sometimes you give 10%, you have to, which you ostensibly should have been able to bring to the Beit HaMikdash, and so on and so forth. Now, the rule is you can't eat at all until you do this. It's treif, like it's not kosher as if it were, you know, pork or something. It's actually worse than pork. Except you're allowed to snack. You're allowed to have a temporary sort of if you haven't brought it home yet, you're allowed to nosh a little bit. You have what's called a chilat arai, sort of like a quick snack from this produce. Except on Shabbat. If you have food, if you have vegetables, if you have grain or something, which is not prude, hasn't been tithed, you can't even take a bite, even though it's whatever. Why? Says the Rosh Hashanah, Shlomo Shmuel ben Meir, Rashi's grandson, on that page of the Talmud says, it's very simple, because on Shabbat, all of our actions are transformative. There's no such thing as temporary eating. There's no such thing as snacking. Everything is part of an ambiance in which every bit of physical pleasure that we have, whether through food or whatever the case might be, is part of one's observance of Shabbat, and as a result, that renders every single act of eating that we have deliberative, and therefore the allowance of eating before tithing doesn't apply. In other words, the very, very act of eating on Shabbat is of a totally different order. Why? Because everything is suda. The quality of suda in this regard affects everything, not just the meals, which are sacred by themselves, but also what you snack in between. Man is a different consuming being on Shabbat. Now, that sounds very rarefied, and it actually is, and it's something to think about. It actually has direct implications for what's going to happen in 2 weeks. After we're all exhausted from cooking for 2 days or 3 days, depending on where you are. One of the things that throws everybody into a tizzy whenever Erev Pesach falls on Shabbat is, what are we going to eat? And more importantly, what are we going to use for bread? Because most people, especially most balot bayit, even though men should participate and stuff, at the end of the day, it's still true that the much of the onus of creating the Pesach Tik house falls on the lady of the house. But even so, you know, guys can get into this too. It's not you know, being obsessive is not, being obsessive is a Jewish trait. You can, it can for everybody. What are you going to use for Pesach? My house is Pesachtik. My house is already Pesach. I'm not bringing chametz in. So there are people that stick their heads into paper, into plastic bags, and they're going to have pitot, and they're going to have this, and that crumbs. I just saw a book that was written by a local rabbi who's a very fine post, a really very fine post. Like, he says, use pita. Pita doesn't make crumbs. Don't use chal. Everybody's got a thing. So I would like to offer you an option for my Ashkenazi fellow travelers. This is certainly true for good for Mizrahi travelers because it's not a problem elsewhere in Pesach. Use egg matzahs. They're not so easy to find in Israel. Certainly in America you can find egg matzahs. Egg matzahs are not made of egg matzahs, of eggs anymore. They're made out of actually made with apple juice. Because of the opinion of Rashi, which is codified in the 16th century by the Ramah, by Rav Moshe Isserles, Ashkenazim don't eat them unless you're a little kid, or you can give it to an older person who maybe has trouble digesting matzah. Generally, we don't eat it, but it's not chametz. Now, there are those who argue, but it's also not bread. You can't make a motzi on egg matzahs because they're not made with water. It has a status of cake. It's called patababikisnim. It's a sort of a cakey type of thing. How can you make a bracha? I can say bari bracha. Bari bracha often good. Bari hamotzi lechem in haaretz on that bracha. So here enters the Rav's father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik Zecher Tzadik Lebracha. Rav Moshe said, when Erev Pesach fell on Shabbos sometime in the 30s, I don't know what year. Wait a minute. The Gemara says, the one I just mentioned, that every act of eating, by definition, is transformed on Shabbat into a deliberative action. Se'uda, the meal, is set. The meal is the Shabbat enters. Your meals are kavua. They're already there. They're already waiting to happen. Happens to be that there's a requirement that for a seuda to happen, you have to eat bread so you can bench afterwards. That's what creates a seuda. So you need a combination of a baked good and kviut. Now during the week, you need to have bread because bread has the kind of gravitas. It shouldn't be too heavy, right? Bread has the kind of importance and centrality that you can only be koveya seuda. You can only say, "I now I'm going to sit down to a seuda for purposes of benching or washing over bread proper." However, Shabbat, you don't need that. Because Shabbat has already contributed its part in transforming the act of eating. All you're missing is something that is that is baked. For that purpose, information, you certainly can use egg matzahs. Egg matzahs are not chametz. Hence, you can take two egg matzahs and eat them Friday night, and you can take two egg matzahs and eat them for lunch. And even with Sudash Lishit, as long as you have it before, you finish before, wherever it's 10 o'clock, the fourth hour, when you stop eating chametz. If you're Mizrahi, you can eat as long as you want, because this chumrah was not accepted by the Mizrahiim, by the Sfardim. And Shalom al Yisrael. And then you put the egg matzahs away. Or you save it for your grandchildren or your children or whatever, underage. And that is a practical implication or ramification of the concept of seuda, which directly relates to this year. So we've gone from discussion of what's unique about not using fire in Shabbat, and why did the Torah highlight this this prohibition in this week's parsha, and that took us to a segue through the difference between Shabbat and Chag, and discussion of Onik Shabbat, and fasting on Shabbat, and the definition of seuda. And now a suggestion for how we should keep this Erev Pesach Shchaliot B'Shabbat, but in 2 weeks. So I think at 45 minutes we've done a lot, and I'm going to try to do this more often. I hope you've enjoyed this. I'm going to put this up on Facebook and on my YouTube channel, and I welcome your comments. You're welcome to share this as well. And I wish you all really a phenomenal Shabbat Shalom.